This is Homefront South Dakota, and I'm speaking with Dan Groth. Can you tell me a little bit about your upbringing?
I was brought up in a religious setting in the Hutterite colony down the bottom.
What made you decide to leave?
I was nervous. I wanted to see what's the other side of the hill.
How old were you at the time of the war?
20 years old.
And where were you living at the time?
When the war broke out, I was a bum. In every sense of the word, I followed the harvest.
So, what made you decide to join the military?
After seeing the newsreels on Pearl Harbor, that's what did it. But I was going to join the Seabees, Naval Construction. And, I figured I could do that. And the guy that was doing that, he must have been an old Marine. He questioned me. He said, "I think, fella, you want to go in the Marines." Said, "If you want to kill Japs, you go to the Marines."
What year did you join?
2, 42.
How long were you in the military for?
A little over 4 years.
Was it a difficult transition?
Yes. The discipline was worse in the Marines than it was in the colony. Well, I thought they'd be the other way around, but it wasn't. Well, you didn't have time to think. Once you got in there like that, they taught you how to march. Once you was a Marine, it was 24 hours a day. They controlled your mind.
When you think about life during World War II, what things stand out most in your memory?
The discipline, I think. Now, when I think about it, the discipline the Marines had on us young guys. We had awful good officers, awful good officers. And then, of course, in the early 30s, we already read in the paper and stuff like that. I'm listening to a missionary what the Japs were doing in China. And that one, I think it was Colonel Griffith at that time, he said, "The Japanese military has never been defeated in 1,100 years. In other words, they've never been defeated." You see, you people, the United States Marines, are going to ones that are going to do it, or you'll be slaves forever. And that hit hard. And damn days they didn't have cameras like they have now, but they showed us pictures of what's going on over there. And then to me, they were not human. As far as shooting one, that didn't bother me none.
So, was it difficult to go from the colony to the Marines?
I've been asked that question a lot of time. My dad was the first one, probably. When I come back, then we settled down. And then he asked me, he said, "Could you have done, Danny, could you have done that if you'd have went to Europe? Germans over there. Blood is a little bit thicker than." And that's a hard question to answer. Then I told him, I said, "They're not, to me, they were not human." After I explained that to him, why?
Now, after the war is over, how do you feel about people from that part of the world?
No, I'll never forgive him. I can live with him and stuff like that. I've met some of them afterwards, but it's always in your mind. There's no way I'll ever forgive a male Japanese. I've carried enough scars, enough sores, enough to last 5 lifetimes.
Were you in any prominent battles?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, we started out when we left Australia. I was not in the first wave on Guadalcanal. That was our first engagement with the Japs. But I surfed there. Went in, and then on Tarawa, like on Bougainville there, then in the Mariana Islands on Guam, Iwo Jima. That's when the war, after that, the war was, they dropped the bomb, the war was over. Then we had to go back and repatriate. There you learn something. To bypass the islands, we only took the islands we had to have. Then you had to go back to accept the surrender. So I seen Old Glory go up 3 times. I was there as a Marine guard. Very few people witnessed that once.
After the war was over, how long were you in the Marines for?
Over a year yet.
Can you tell me a little bit more about Iwo Jima?
Iwo Jima was that's the last battle, last real battle, and they already knew our fight, the way we fight. There was more foxholes, you know. We say we come in from this side. There was more of them facing. When we go by, they open that little lid. We call them spider deals, and shoot you in the back. So you was in danger at all times. The only time. And more so on Iwo Jima than the other islands, that it's hard to crawl underneath when they fire. It's hard to, that's when you crawl forward. That's something you have to learn again. When they shoot, they have to shoot up. They can't shoot down on you because you'd see them and you put a bullet between their eyes. Same thing with us. So whenever the firing is hardest, that's when most people want to run the other direction. That's when the front of the front, like I was, the scouts, we had to go forward.
Were you ever wounded?
Yeah, I was wounded on Guam and I was wounded on Iwo Jima. I was shot both of them, always the left leg. Always the left leg. Why? Don't ask me. And then he never drawed blood, but he bit it so hard that it still hurts. Yeah, I jabbed it. You know, I got him from the back. You're down to hand-to-hand, close quarter, they call it. And I got him from the back and he got his hand. He never draw blood, but it's there, it's sore. Now I kick enough pills, you don't feel it.
Did you learn anything about yourself that surprised you?
Yes, I think so. I didn't think that right off the bat. I didn't think that I was just a, you know, colony boy, a South Dakota Indian hunter, they called us. But right off the bat, I was in command. I got sworn in Omaha, Nebraska in the morning. I had four white guys and an Indian. And the lady was in charge, babysit us and everything like, took us on the Challenger. That's the train that goes West Coast. There was GI coaches on there like that. And fed us supper to a restaurant. And took us into the coach. This is your bunk. This is your bunk. This is five of us. Hand me that envelope. Said Dan Gross. He said you're in charge. Here's the meal ticket. Still the other end. And I've been told that a thousand times. That it's that voice.
That makes people want to put you in charge.
I guess so. Our intelligence officer. He boy. He was good. See, I was a scout, the aerial photos up there, certain places in the jungle, what he wanted to know, we were sent in there like that all the time. When the patrol come up, the guys, Gross, he said, you're in charge, no matter how what the rank was. At one time, things like that you don't forget. A new guy come from the States, where he got his stripes from, God only knows. He said, I'm in charge. He said, I got you all outranked. Gladly. Boy, I stepped aside. Coming back in, it was a major. He started asking me. I said, he took over. He's in charge. He said, yeah. He said, who the hell are you? Then he told me, I'm going to tell you something, fella. He said, leaders are born. They're not made. You're homemade. There's something about that crackling voice, I don't know.
What did the war mean to you? What was at stake during the war for you?
Just to win. Just one thing, win, win. Win. But we were always reminded, you know, the language is different. Always reminded by a door up there, be a door across. Only the best walk through this door, the United States Marines. And there's no such a thing as canned in the Marine military, in a Marine language. Then, and things like that, you're constantly reminded. And your mind is in full control, all of, in training, stateside, yeah. And then, we had training, but the language is different. Right off the bat, and then you pick that up. But the third day in the Marine Corps, the first day, you know, in Pendleton, down there at San Diego, there's a yellow mark and the green mark. You put your foot there. Now you don't move till you're told to move. You're froze there. I was a giggler. To me, that was all funny. I don't know what I did. He chewed somebody's butt out. Oh, they break you down. Take 5 days to break your spirit and then build you up. I looked forward and my foot slipped about that much. And he come over. Oh, my God. Heck, I was queer. Now, I never heard of that word before. And he hit me with some of them on that, hit me over the head. Oh, they're off in the gut and everything like that. They brought you down. And then that one guy, first one, then the second DI took over, an old German crunk guy, went down on his knees, one knee, talked to God. My gosh, Lord, where did you find all that scum? Make men out of that bunch of scum? We have to make Marines out of that scum? See how they break your spirit. And the other one wasn't that bad. But them first two guys, my, that one, that Cronkite, he was something. They were down in that one knee and then.
What became the high and low points of life during the war?
Oh, that was different low points where you're so dirty and filthy. No, you fight for day and night in the mud. It rains down in the tropics for 3-4 days. People don't realize it. But when things go that bad, everything lets go. And your waist is baked on.
Were there any positive things about the war for you?
Just to win. That's always in your mind. That's burned into you. It's to win.
Do you think you would have felt differently had you been fighting the Germans rather than the Japanese?
I've been asked that question many times. That's hard to answer. I just don't know. Like I said, them kids, the other one said, the Germans never done nothing to me. We invaded them. They didn't invade us.
Did your experience make you decide anything about the rest of your life?
No. No, I had full intention to go to stay in the Marines. You know, that's the only life I knew. I knew I could make it till I met the girl there. Well, we got together. She was in nurses training when I was home. See, you get 90-day furlough, actually, about something like that, quite a while in a way. Then mustering out pay and all that same money you saved. And I was home, and I was lost. I wasn't going back to Colony. I knew that. And like I said, Marines is the only life I knew. Then she come to Mitchell Nurses Training. She was no nurse in the military. She was a mechanic. You know, with the fighter pilots, when they train them airplanes, when they wreck them, that's what them women did. They repaired them. And then I met her, and then from then on, it was, she was military too. And we've been together ever since. At that time, they were strict. If you're out, I got discharged as a corporal with 2 stripes, and you lose a stripe every 90 days. And I know if I understood right or not, if that's over, I go back in, I have to go through boot camp. Well, you know, it'd been easier the first time, second time, but nevertheless, well, like I said, I imagine if I wouldn't have met her, I'd have drifted back in. They had me down as a potential.
After the war was over, was it possible to put it behind you completely, or was it hard for you to adjust back to civilian life?
I had a whole year there, peacetime service. So there's a lot of, your mind changes a lot too. A lot of guys right off the bat went home. You know, when that deal was over, Army had the point system. So many points for certain things. But I was a regular. I had 4 years, give or take, you know, you served. And in other words, it's for life. I could have been called any time after that. And one time I thought I did, when Mary generated the envelope come. Going to Korea there when they were going. Brother, you know, I was shaking when I opened it. And as luck would have it, it said there again, a big deal there, like stickers, once a Marine, always a Marine. And it already started showing up then, you know, in construction then. I was the superintendent there for Vittito, foreman. Them young guys joining the workforce right off the bat. Boy, the question they asked about the Marine Corps. Those that went in, what made you? Well, Dan Groves, Dan Groves. I got a medal there someplace, Recruiter of the Year.
What do you want people today to know about your experience and what you went through?
You got this thing right there, and that I don't watch it enough like I should. That History Channel, boy, there's a lot there that, you know, people tell me afterwards. Even different statements that I make, and then the next day or so like that, they said, "Well, I was thought you're kidding." You know, Pearl Harbor. See, that was Admiral took over right off the bat, run the show there like that. And then that's a different ball game then. And I was in Pearl Harbor only 5 days when he formed the convoy, fighting people. That's the high priority on the ship. So we were way in. I always thought from where the ship's laid out at the entrance going in, about 2 miles. Sailors telling me, hell, that's 11, 10 miles into Pearl City. And we were in there like that, and you've seen all that destruction there again, that helped. Now there you're talking about 10 miles there from the ships out there into Pearl City. Everything was burned on both sides. And then, my God, that's all part of condition you. And then when we come out, the convoy, most of our ships were gone. We didn't have very much. And the Japs had all the oil. They had everything there, clear everything. They were bombing Australia, and they hit for Australia. And they took the convoy zigzag always. Couldn't go straight. It seems to me like it was over 40 days on that ship, and you don't get very much. Don't get very much exercise. You get some, but you learn a lot. The heavens. See, that's before. You had REA and running water and everything like that. So everybody knew, every kid knew, the fireman kid knew the heavens, the North Star, you know, the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, how it goes around, everything like that. As you go down to the Southern Hemisphere now, them sailors on there, you know, that take them readings. Oh, they were good about that. You go over there and they'd explain. They had a bunch of Marines down there. They explained to us. Take a good look at the North Star. That's probably the last time you'll ever see it. It'll disappear. The Southern Cross will show up as you hit the Southern Hemisphere. And boy, they were always right. That day, it pointed out part of the Southern Cross. But the heavens on the ship now, see, everything is dark, everything is black. And then it's laying there when it wasn't raining, and look at them heavens, the stars.
What do you think that we need to remember about World War II?
Freedom isn't cheap. We want it. It's for the new and the next generation down the line to hold on to it.
You had told me that you went to Nagasaki. Tell me a little bit about what you saw in Nagasaki.
Destruction. As far as your eyes could see, far as your eyes could see, everything was burned. In the town, everything was burned. Now there was a Catholic mission there, a big church, stone church, a brick, a masonry, over 5 miles away. There's a sign there. It was belief where it exploded, way up high. But in that church, you know, the wood around the window frames and everything was all ashes. The nails laying there, and then the heat, 5 miles away. But every building was. It was not. Everything was burned. And then we were exposed to an atomic deal. for a long time, still something once in a while, when I go over to the Veterans Hospital, they check that. But the lady like you doing it, I ask what she's looking for. Well, that's that form, I gotta check this and gotta check that. See different things that he was exposed to. Now on the island of Guam, we had a guy here in town that had that disease where your flesh fades away. McDougal had that. And there's only one place on earth, they tell me, where you can get that. If I ever ate with the natives, native food and stuff like that, when you're hungry and they go by where they eat there like that, they hand you something. They have little round crackers like these. I don't know what it's made out of, but I chew them, I swallow them and everything like that. But I thought I seen cannibalism over there like that. You take a monkey, it's just like a human. Now, they have no knives over there. That's the natives now. They twist it. I know how they do it. The tail, they throw that away. And where they, on their stick, where they turn, the fire is over there with that big old shell, seashell. She throws that underneath like that. And my God, we walk by. It looked, you know, the hands, see the hair, everything is on there. That has to be soaked off, you know. Oh, and you know, she offered you some. You know, that some Marines that tasted it. I know two of them that did.
Did you eat anything strange?
No, my mind and my stomach. When I went to China, to this day, I can't eat. You can have the most beautiful cake and anything beautiful. You put China on there, I'm done. What I seen them eat over there. Now, I ate over there. I ate some good food. We went in. It was on the coast, anyway. All from all over the world, the people come in, you know, to get, you know, trade and stuff like that. And they was telling the embassy there, that one restaurant, boys got food, went in. British menu, British. Boy, it was good and it smelled good. Round table about like this here, tablecloth on there, tools to eat with. And then the lady come by, and I crave chicken noodle soup to this day like that. Oh, so I said, no, they haven't got chicken noodles, though, but no noodles. But lazy noodles, that's what you call it. That's when you take that dough and rub it down. You know, damn pizza. And it was, oh my God, that was good. So the next time we went in, same thing. I ordered the same doggone thing. She just brought that bowl, and about from here to the window over there, the next table over, a Chinaman come in. Big hair, head shaved, big son of a gun. He sat down, and like I said, mine and my dear, I kept looking over. Three of them women ride on them, see, chopsticks. One of them with a big bowl, looked like our oyster stew, you know, that white, milky soup like. Another one, a black bowl, and I look at that black bowl. My God, there were worms, they were moving. Milk snakes, what it was. And boy, he reached in with that chopstick, picked up a couple of them, dropped them in there. So that's the end of China food. I've seen a couple other things like that. But over there, it's a different culture. A different culture. And they look down on us. China, Japan too. The Northern European people, anything with blue eyes, they point out we're monkeys. See, they're over there, yeah, they're black eyes. And then, you know, I like that. And more than one pointed that out to me. You know, whenever there's a live monkey or over there like that. Monkey, you monkey.
So how did that make you feel?
And by that time, the war was over quite a while already, so you had to, right off the bat, the very first bunch of us at the embassy that I went out on leave. See, the guys been there a long time already. You're told by the older guys what to do. It's all sign language. Anyway, he come back in, and that one guy from Texas, somebody asked him what they like, Goog, what do they like? He said they're a bunch of, he didn't say hoodlum, some other doggone thing. And the Chinaman on the British payroll, He talked British. See, the British talk different than we do. He said, "I beg your pardon, young man." Boy, that draw my attention. Then he explained to us how bad our history is. That there was that the so-and-so 600 years before Columbus got lost. I was pointed out that more than once. And then, but there was pretty good. There was a lot of German over there, so I got along there. More German than there was English, really.
And you spoke fluent German?
Well, I took four languages when I went in. I grew up with four. And then the guy was civilian that gave me the test in San Diego down there like that. Asked me what the hell I was doing in the Marine Corps in Southeast Asia. Well, you're one of them that's afraid to shoot your cousin, huh? Long before they dropped the bomb, quite a while, we had once a week, ever so often, their Japanese occupation language. The words you'll have to have to, we'll occupy it. We were hoping we would. There was 80 words. But the guy there that teaching it was reading it out of a book. He didn't even know how to do that. But the way with the people now is a different ball game.